The Vice President of the Theosophical Society, Miss Joy Mills, and her subject, Rebirth, the Human Necessity.
All and good afternoon, friends. I think it is very nice of all of you to break into your Sunday afternoon, and what I am certain is a rather exciting cricket match, to come to a theosophical talk. I don't understand anything about cricket. I hope that I understand a little bit about the theosophical philosophy, and therefore may share that with you. It was, of course, the American philosopher Henry Adams who once defined philosophy as unintelligible answers to insolvable problems. Well, as we look out about on our world today and are concerned with the many events that are going on everywhere in the world, it certainly seems to be the truth that the problems, at least, are insoluble, that we scarcely know where to turn for answers. In spite of all of our efforts, somehow war does continue, at least sporadically and in various places. Despite all the efforts to achieve some kind of fairness for life everywhere, poverty continues, pollution continues. In spite of our effort to eradicate prejudice, there are still prejudices among peoples, whether because of the color of skin or the way of worship. When we turn, of course, to our own lives, we are perhaps even more aware of the nature of the problems that seem to beset us, questions that are constantly before us, so that we feel all we can do is reach a kind of uneasy compromise with life, a kind of adjustment, an uneasy adjustment in which our fears and our hopes are somehow balanced. Now, I would like to attempt, if I may, this afternoon, not so much to solve all the diversity of the problems that confront us, and certainly I hope that what I say will not comprise unintelligible answers, but rather to come, if we can, to what I suggest is the central question confronting us today, and therefore, what may be the necessary attitude, the necessary point of view which we may achieve in order to arrive at a reasonable answer, to arrive at a kind of condition of existence, if I may put it that way, a way of living which is not an uneasy compromise, but which is meaningful, which has some significance for us. I have always believed that if one could ask the right question, one would arrive at the right answer. Now, this may seem very strange, but let me put it in a very, very simple manner, by looking at some quite ordinary, everyday experiences. Let us say that you have had a very tiring day. You have been very busy, perhaps working at whatever your occupation is, coming home, perhaps working in the garden, cooking a meal, or whatever it may be, and you are exhausted. You are absolutely physically exhausted. The question arises, what do I do? Now, the answer is inherent in the question, is it not? The thing to do is to lie down and have a good night's sleep, is it not? Let us say that you are invited out to dinner, and it is a very large meal, and everything on the table is something that you enjoy. and so you are inclined to eat a little bit too much. Now, maybe this never has happened to you, but I presume that at some time or other it may have happened, that you are inclined to consume a little bit beyond what is your normal capacity. What is the answer? Simply to stop eating. A very, very simple answer, to push away from the table, as it were. Whatever the experience, one could go on with this kind of illustration. But what I am getting at is simply that no matter what the experience may be in our mundane lives, however enjoyable it may be, and the dinner that one has participated in and partaken of over generously may be a delightful experience. It is for the moment all-consuming in your attention and interest. You are enjoying the dinner. The activity of the day, including that little extra bit of gardening, may be a very enjoyable and exciting and adventuresome experience. But there comes a point when you have had enough, when the body seeks something else, when we seek something else. However eagerly we have anticipated any experience, there comes a moment when that experience has reached what we might call its peak. We have had enough. And what we do then is move quite logically into its opposite, from exhaustion, from activity, into rest, from eating into fasting, if I may put it that way, at least until the next meal appears. From whatever the experience, being with a group of people, enjoying being with others, suddenly one wants to retreat. One has had enough. One says, you know, let's quit. I need to be alone for a time. What I am getting at very simply is that the principle of change emerges as basic to all experience, which is to say to life itself. Actually, we seek change. We want it, even when we do not know it, and even when we do not ask for it, and even though at times we may seem to resist it. If we really analyze the matter, if we look at our own lives, we will soon discover, however, that it is not change that we resist. It is not the movement from whatever the experience or the event into its opposite that we resist. It is rather the consequence of change that we resist. What may occur as a consequence of moving into the opposite of the experience? Certainly, we recognize that we cannot go on forever eating a huge meal, however delightful the food may be, however much we may say we enjoy it. It is not, in other words, the end of the dinner that we resist. It is the consequences of having eaten too much that we resist. So it is always the consequences of the experience that somehow brings about this condition of existence. But change, then, appears to be the only constant in our experience, the only constant in life itself. This moment is obviously not the same as the last moment. Tomorrow cannot be the same as today. No experience is fully repeatable because circumstances, including ourselves, have undergone change. The film of existence, in other words, never runs backward. However much one might like to turn back the clock to live the day over again, even in spite of the fact that there are ways of traveling, which I myself am now taking, where one crosses an international date line, and this week I will live March 1st twice, it will not be an exactly repeatable experience. It cannot be, because one moves on and one changes, even one's attitude towards whatever the experience is. So the question, quite simply, the question that is the key question before us today as thinking human beings is quite simply, can change be meaningful? Can it be directed? Can it be purposeful and significant in some way? Perhaps we can even more closely define the question that is before us right now. And that is, can we, you and I, immersed in this process of change, ourselves continuously changing, act in a manner in the world, act in a manner that will be purposeful, that will be directed, that will be significant? In other words, do events just happen? Just happen to us? Or do we happen to the world in a meaningful manner? If events happen to us, then we cannot change the world, and we might as well stop thinking that we can bring about change in the world. Whatever changes occur in ourselves will have no importance, no significance in the world about us. But if we happen to the world, that is, if we are geared in, meshed into the whole process of life itself, then the manner of our change, the way in which we change, the process which we call ourselves, that is the I in each one of us, will affect all external processes and conditions. I would like to propose to you that in my judgment, this is truly the central issue before humanity today. Quite simply, the issue of my involvement in the world, including, therefore, my commitment to life itself. It concerns, in effect, not only every action in which I engage, but more fundamentally, the basis from which I act. That is, the psychological impetus, the mental and emotional impetus to action, and the alignment of that impetus with a deeper source to which I refer as myself, the true self, that with which I identify myself. Perhaps I can best illustrate this to you by referring to a recent incident of a discussion I had with a friend of mine. We were discussing together the extent to which we are responsible for our environment, each one of us, as well as for ourselves. To what extent am I responsible for the world about me, my environment in which I live? And I suggested to my friend that, in my view, everything in the universe is interrelated, that the vision of the poet of the last century, Francis Thompson, is in effect a basic truth when he wrote, "Everything near and far together hiddenly linked are, that thou canst not pluck a flower without the troubling of a star." In other words, I said to my friend, I conceive of the universe as truly a universe, not a multiverse, one system in which man plays a significant role. And that indeed the only reason that we can even communicate with each other is that all individual consciousnesses are rooted in one universal consciousness. That this alone makes possible communication among us. And to substantiate my argument, I tried to cite the work of the French historian and part-time physicist de Broglie, whose remarkable discoveries on the nature of light, utilizing the findings of Einstein and Max Planck and others on the nature of matter and energy, illustrated that light has both mass and energy. And so it was de Broglie, for example, who concluded that an atom, the energy system which we call the atom, has not only a kind of localized heart of stable matter, but also broadcasts an expanding pulsation, so that the atom is not a closed system, you see, but actually is an open system broadcasting a pulsation always outwards and what he called forever in step and extending all over the universe. Something like the now known rise and fall of the ocean tides, for example, under each advancing wave. So all of this was to suggest that whatever happens in any part of the universe has an effect on every other part of the universe, do you see? That if there is this pulsating quality to all atoms, and everything in the universe is composed of atoms, that there is not only the heart of stable matter which is convertible into energy, but this energy pulsates, that then everything that happens everywhere in the universe has an effect everywhere else. So my friend then said to me, well, on the basis of your theory, do you think that you are responsible for earthquakes? Now this, my friends, is a very serious question, you see. Not that I think the vice president of the Theosophical Society can create an earthquake, though one never knows. Stranger things have happened, I suppose. But rather, is each individual in some way responsible for earthquakes? Now, it's a serious question, as I say, because if I can cause an earthquake or you can cause an earthquake, think of the power that is present within us. But if there is an interrelatedness throughout the entire scheme of the universe, if all life is interrelated, if there is a unitary source of consciousness out of which self-consciousness arises, then we cannot divorce ourselves from any event, any circumstance, any condition, anywhere in the universe. Let me put it a bit differently. Either it makes an enormous difference what I think, what I feel, and what I do, or it makes no difference at all. And it is as simple as that, my friends. Either it makes a tremendous difference in the universal economy of things, what you think, what you feel, and how you act, or it makes no difference and you have no effect whatsoever. You cannot say it makes a difference at this moment but makes no difference at the next moment, you see. You cannot sort of come in and out of the universe. Either you are in it or you are out of it. Either you are embedded in the whole process or you are not in it at all. So either my mood and my mode of conduct has a bearing upon external events, or it makes no difference at all whether I am violent or peaceful, whether I am in an inner rage or a state of contemplation, whether I express hate or love, envy or compassion, indifference or concern. Brotherhood, in other words, brotherhood is either an experienceable fact, an undeniable fact, experienceable at every moment of our existence, or it is the soporific cliché of the idealist. One analyst, indeed, has suggested that the present wave, which is called the counterculture, that is sweeping across the world, particularly in student life and among young people, exhibited in such a variety of ways as drug taking and rebellion against authority and the development of alternate lifestyles and so on, is all based on the central idea that we must initiate a new stage in man's relatedness to nature and the natural. The current interest almost everywhere in the world, not only in the West, but one is very much aware of it also in India and in other Eastern countries, in such occult arts as astrology, the use of the I Ching, the tarot, all of this expresses an interior, often unconscious drive, not only to see if one can divine the future, but more essentially, how can one become connected with the natural life processes, harmonize oneself, gear oneself with the universe of which one is indeed a part. So I am not suggesting, you see, that we cause earthquakes, but that there is a relationship between everything we do and think and feel and whatever happens in our environment. Indeed, it has been suggested that the formlessness of present life has three obvious aspects. There is, if we look out about us, our environmental chaos, which includes, as we all recognize, a tragic waste of both human and natural resources. There is certainly, as we look at humanity over the globe, social chaos, which includes a continued reliance on war, as well as a failure to solve the very human problems of poverty, racism, and religious bigotry. And finally, as we look at ourselves, there is an inner chaos, including our individual inability to live in harmony with ourselves, our inability to accept our own internal psychic conditions. Now, I suggest that these three aspects are so interrelated that actually to solve the first two, the environmental and social chaos of our time, we must learn to deal with our own internal chaos. And this is so because, as I've already suggested, the universe is a universe, one system. In the fields today of biology and psychology and the life scientists, to which an increasing number of scientists are turning, and I hope you've had that remarkable series here by Dr. Bronowski on the Ascent of Man, in which he points out again and again the emphasis on the life sciences, because it is recognized ultimately that even the physical sciences have their impact on the life sciences, become life sciences indeed. Scientists today are recognizing that all organisms are unitary. For example, modern biology has discovered a very interesting fact in studying cell life, that every cell seems to have within it all the possibilities that were in the egg itself. The presence of the entire organism may be found in every cell. A number of eminent biologists have pointed out that when the raw stuff of life, protoplasm, takes form, it does so as a unity in which the eventual outcome of the entire process of growth is present in principle in the seed, which is the carrier of the organism. And at least one school of psychology, that following Dr. Carl Jung, suggests that the same principle applies to basic psychic processes, that there is a unitary principle in the psyche that tends to make it a single unit, so that the processes of the psyche reveal patterns known as the great archetypes. The psyche, like protoplasm, is a process, ever in movement. But there is an encompassing and directive flow, a principle underlying this movement, an ultimate internal unity that shapes the immeasurable products of life into an orderly and harmonious whole, a single self-directive principle, it is suggested, which contains the goal within its very nature. The oakness is present in the acorn, in other words. That which will culminate is present in the seed, which is the carrier of its own future. So that all organisms, being unitary, are also interrelated, and there is an interrelationship because the source is unitary. As one scientist, Dr. David Bohm of London University, has written, all interactions between atomic particles have now to be described in terms of individual quantum jumps. Ultimately, each particle is thus linked inseparably with everything else in the universe. It follows then, wrote Dr. Bohm, that the universe as a whole is to be thought of as a web of indivisible links rather than as a collection of separately existing objects. And the whole merges into the totality of the universe, including the human observer. We are part of a web of indivisible links, and what happens at any point in that web influences every other point of the web. So let us return for a moment to our central question and define it now a little more closely. Reframe it, in other words, on the basis of these ideas. Can we, you and I, immersed in the process of change, ourselves continually undergoing change, in a unitary system in which a fundamental principle is interrelationship, can we, who are capable of thinking and feeling and willing and acting, can we act in a manner that will give direction and purpose to the entire world process, to the circumstances about us? Can we act in a manner that will ultimately bring about that condition of harmony, which is peace, which we devoutly hope to achieve in our world? A condition in which the beauty of brotherhood, which is the beauty of diversity, will flower naturally in terms of a concern for all living things, a concern for the needs of each other, an awareness of the essential humanness of every person. Well, to answer this question, I think we have to be prepared to take a radically new and different step than we have been accustomed to thinking. We must act in a new manner, a manner fully founded on the knowledge at our present disposal, a manner that will recognize that whether or not we caused an earthquake, whether we caused the outbreak of war or the rise of pollution or any other external problem, is less essential than to be aware of our present involvement in the total process, our intimate involvement, and hence our responsibility for the processes of life. We are responsible, in other words, for humanity's next step, because we are the humanity that must take the next step. So that we must bring about that kind of purposeful change in ourselves that will ultimately bring about a meaningful change in the world, in the environmental and social conditions. This is because we really must throb, if I may put it this way, in accordance with the pulse beat itself of the planet Earth. As one writer has said, the pulse beat of planet Earth has not yet been counted, but a pulse is there, and it is our own pulse. We must throb in accordance with that. To understand the nature of the change, however, that is imperative at this time, we must add to the concept of the unitary nature of all living organisms and the interrelationship that exists at every level of life, that the process of change is always rhythmical in nature. Always rhythmical. So this third principle must now be added. Change is always rhythmical because it is based on this fundamental pulse beat of planet Earth. It is based on the fundamental rhythm which I indicated at the very outset of my talk in discussing very common, everyday, mundane experiences. We discover this rhythm in our own lives, and biology has done much today to talk about the biological clocks inherent in every living organism. We all have our own biological built-in clocks, and we move in accordance with them. This is one of the things that has been discovered with jet travel and so-called jet lag, that there is a built-in clock that very often for many people, one has to sort of stop and catch up with oneself after a very long trip by jet. That there is indeed this rhythmic nature of the entire life process, a pulsating quality extending throughout the universe. And this pulsation, which is in evidence at every level, reveals itself, of course, even in our physical bodies. For instance, we certainly all recognize that our bodies are aggregates composed of tiny lives or cells which are continuously undergoing a cycle of evolutionary experience, a ceaseless activity in renewing the vehicle. It is impossible for you, for example, to leave this room this afternoon in precisely the same physical body you brought into the room. It's not that I intend to keep you here, I assure you, until your next incarnation. It is a simple fact that you cannot leave this room today with precisely the same atomic structure with which you entered the room. Cells are continually dying and being reborn. We perceive the straight line of growth of the physical body and see it as a straight line, so that it seems to maintain its identity over a significant period of time. Fortunately, a sufficiently long period of time that you do not wake up in the morning and look in the mirror and see a totally new person staring back at you. You may, of course, compare the image that you see with an image that you saw 25 years ago and find some remarkable differences in the two images, because we grow, as we know, in all sorts of ways. Sometimes I think, particularly here in the West, tending to want to imitate Plato's idea of the spherical man. But this, of course, is because we haven't pushed away from the table perhaps soon enough. There is a certain yoga involved in that exercise. But what we do is observe the identity over a sufficiently long period of time to know that we are the same person. But if the totality of our consciousness were comprised in one cell of the physical body, we would become aware of the rhythmic law inherent operative within it, a law of constant renewal. Every tiny life in the aggregation we call our physical body is following this rhythmic pattern of renewal. Only the brain cells, it is said, do not renew themselves. But experiment has shown that memory traces, which is the result of the energy waves, the pulsation, as it were, memory traces are duplicated more than 600 times in a single lifetime. So the pattern of renewal is present, even if not actual in terms of physical matter. And that pattern extended in time, of course, is what we refer to as reincarnation, the mode by which growth is achieved. Now, change then is not only rhythmic, it is meaningful. For reincarnation is the cyclic unfoldment of life in vehicles suited to its expression. But because the pattern of renewal, the archetypal pattern of renewal, is present, the change that we are seeking and the change that must come about today does not require the deferral of the solution to our problems to future existences in some other time period. In other words, while reincarnation provides for the tremendous possibility of the ongoing quality of life in terms of a lifespan, a time span, consonant with the divine potentiality to be unfolded, we can effect here and now the mutational rebirth, which is absolutely essential, the human necessity, if humanity is to survive. We can bring about now the conditions we seek through that kind of mutational rebirth, which is effected by applying the pattern of renewal to our very lives here and now. And it is this rebirth that I propose is indeed the human necessity. To understand the nature of this rebirth, it may be helpful if we draw an analogy from nature itself, particularly in reference to the transformations undergone by certain animals in the course of their lives. That transformation which brings about the metamorphosis of the caterpillar into the butterfly, for example, has always served as a metaphor for intimations of a deeper and higher being. That the same creature in the quiescent pupa, the nympha or chrysalis, has provided us with an image of contemplation, of serene expectation of things to come, the promise of a mutational rebirth, is well known in all literature. And it is now known by scientists that in insects with the complete metamorphosis, from the larva to the pupa to the mature form, it is now known that the egg contains the rudiments of all the organs that distinguish the various stages of its development. And in addition, all the equipment for the processes leading from one stage to another. Nothing is added at any point, in other words. And this, I think, has great symbolism and, by analogy, great meaning for us. Nothing needs to be added. We have the equipment to bring about the mutational rebirth which can transform ourselves and transform the world. Three radically different forms, for example, are prefigured in the egg of the butterfly. In the caterpillar stage, certain organs function fully, but certain others that will develop only in the mature stage are no more than little groups of cells that scientists call imaginal discs and lodged in the brain of the insect. Experiment has revealed a complex mechanism by which the modifications of the various forms and the transformation from one to another are strictly regulated. And the study of the first processes of development show that an infinitesimal quantity of living substances constitutes the egg and creates these patterns and guides the development. Science does not yet know what remarkable change takes place in the caterpillar that after a long monotonous period of feeding on one plant, sometimes just at one particular plant, it looks around for a different environment favorable for pupation. And there the most remarkable transformation takes place when the caterpillar turns into the quiescent chrysalis, in many cases spinning a most delicate and marvelous cocoon. What change brings this about, as it were? And there within the cocoon, all of the organs that were present in the caterpillar are transformed, brought into a kind of emulsion, a kind of viscous, protoplasmic, non-differentiated substance, that out of that, finally, will emerge, finally, the butterfly to spread its wings, altered now for a totally new and different environment. A number of experiments have been carried on, for example, that have showed that the brain of the insect exerts an indispensable influence on the entire process of metamorphosis. For example, it has been shown that a caterpillar can be kept alive for a certain length of time, quite a considerable length of time, without a brain, but no metamorphosis will occur. Man's whole focus is at the level of mind, of consciousness, in the thinking principle. And it is as though, by analogy, it is there in that determination of choice, which is the uniquely human capacity that brings about the kind of metamorphosis necessary for the mutational rebirth that I have in mind. There is a famous statement, the readiness is all. We have to be ready to undertake this kind of mutational rebirth. And the crises of our time surely demand nothing less from us that will result in the resolution of the world problem. Such a rebirth was described by the great Christian teacher when he told his disciples, "Except ye be converted," which is to change the focus, to turn around on a central pin, as it were, and to look in a new direction. Except ye be converted and become as little children, ye shall not enter into the kingdom of heaven. And so we must turn ourselves around on that central point of choice within us and become indeed as little children. That is to say, with the purity of perception that sees only beauty, the wonder and mystery of life everywhere. You all remember the story in the Christian scripture that when Nicodemus, the great ruler, inquired of Jesus how he could perform the miracles attributed to him, saying, "No man can do these miracles that thou doest except God be with him," Jesus responded, "Verily I say unto you again, except a man be born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." Nicodemus, you'll remember, was of course very puzzled, for he thought of rebirth as return to a past condition, to a previous state of unawareness. How can a man be born again when he is old? And so on. But the Christian teacher made clear that the kind of rebirth that was essential did not depend merely on living a certain number of incarnations, and that reincarnation was accepted at that time is now amply proven, and there is ample evidence to show it. But rather on an interior conversion, a change into a new condition, a turning with the essential self, which means to become as a little child, to bring about the birth within of that Christ consciousness which is always depicted as a little child. We are all of us inherently beings in growth, and the need for growth, which gives rise on the larger time scale of evolution to the structure and the concept of reincarnation, this is inherent in our very being, and it requires us to carry life further than the form in which we now find it. Man alone has the capacity for self-transformation, self-realization, self-knowledge, and self-action, the ability to redirect our existence, if we will, through the development of resources that are present as imaginal disks within the very fiber of our being. The rebirth that is so necessary today is the transformation that will affect the universe so that the harmonization of all life's forces and energies will be brought about. Yes, my friends, I think it is not too much to say that whether or not we caused earthquakes, we can bring about a condition in which there will be no earthquakes. By our thoughts, by our feelings, by our actions, by transforming ourselves from within, we can bring about a world at peace. You may say, oh, the people at the United Nations will do this. The political leaders, or those who are the sages and seers of our particular time. But it is dependent on each one of us awakened, as it were, as the caterpillar awakes to the possibility of moving within the quiescent stage of the chrysalis. So we must awake to the need to turn within and discover within ourselves these deific resources implanted there from the beginning of our humanhood. For the rebirth that is necessary is not an escape from time, the processes of time, the processes of change. It is rather the bringing of ourselves into a total participation in the universal processes in so dynamic a manner, so vital a manner, that we are never for a moment unmindful of, we can never forget our intimate connection with all life. Universes appear and disappear in the vast scale of cosmic cycles. Our own lives reflect this cosmic process. Reincarnation is but one of its forms. But the pattern is established here and now and may be revealed in that rebirth which transforms us from within. Do not defer to some future life. Become transformed here and now. Our freedom is not an escape from the world process, but is achieved within it. And I think that for all practical purposes, living in such a manner, living in that pulsating universe, in the flow of change, in that change that is rhythmic and natural, in which we find our own peace, as it were, not in holding still the processes of time, which we cannot do, but in moving gently with it. Living in that manner means developing the child heart and learning to love all things a little more. Learning to love the beauty in everything we see, not impatient, but always patient with the processes of life, for it means sensing the sweet side of life, smiling a little more. As I hear almost every morning in India on the Voice of America, there's a phrase that they sign off with every day. If you see someone without a smile, give him one of yours. And perhaps that is the most beautiful gift that we can ultimately give to another and that we can give to the world. For it means standing up for the sake of right, for right's sake, not for any preference that the position may bring us. And one then does not bother too much about whether one is being personal or impersonal, for rather such a rebirth means that we live from a deeper, immortal self, thinking of oneself as part of the totality of life. We live and move and breathe in each other and for each other. And this is the kind of rebirth that alone can bring about a new world, a world that we so desperately need to be building. And we, my brothers and friends, we can help build it if we move and live from this new sense, reborn each day, greeting each day with its newness, and ourselves newly created for each day.